Hi. Hey, thanks for coming out. This is the Hemingway Summer Poetry Series, week two at Hop Farm. Thank you for being here for this. We really appreciate it. Some clerical stuff. If you want to order food or a beer, you can use this handy UPC thing that's sitting on the table, or whatever they're called. I've never been able to successfully use one of these, but that is not an issue with Hop Farm. That's just my own ineptitude. But you can order from here, or the lovely Herb and Carly at the bar will also do it face-to-face, old school. Also, you have heard that this season we have brought back the Hemingway's Open Mic, a beloved part of this series that we had to mothball for a little while, but it's back. Right over here by the speaker on the counter there is a sign-up sheet. Are we doing, where's Joan? There's Joan. Are we doing five again, or what? Five. So there are five spots on that sheet to sign up, and if you're so inclined, please do. We had a really, really wonderful open mic last time. Really impressive group of readers there. Thanks again for coming out. We're getting comfortable in the new digs. I hope you guys like it. You can feel free to spill beers somewhere here. You don't have to worry about damaging a book like at White Whale, which takes a little of that of the nerves out of the whole thing. Thanks. So tonight I just wanted to sort of doff the cap, pay homage to a friend of the series for many, many years, Ed O'Chester, who passed away last year. Ed was a great friend of the Hemingway series. He read in the back room for us, I think, quite a few times. He is greatly missed. Ed's work at the Pitt Poetry Series as an editor, just the amazing list of poets that he published on that list, Ross Gay, Larry Levis, Sharon Olds, Toy Derricotte, Billy Collins, no relation, is just incredible. And Ed's own poetry has always been a favorite of mine. I think if there is such a thing as a Pittsburgh School of Poetry, Ed's work, both as editor and writer, really kind of prescribes what that is. It's not just a blue-collar aesthetic, I think. There's just so much humor and intelligence and wit, and it just has such cultural nuance to it. And it's just really fucking funny, too. And I think that's what a lot of us who do write strive to incorporate so many things into the poem, and to be able to do it as smoothly and naturally as Ed was able to so consistently do it has always impressed me. By way of intro tonight, I just wanted to read one of Ed's poems, and I will attempt to do it justice. This is the title poem from his collection, Miracle Mile. And he dedicated this one to Jerry Stern, which is nice. I didn't realize I had forgotten that until I picked this up again, that this was for Jerry, another great Pittsburgh poet. Miracle Mile. Why weep? I am going to drive past Elby's Big Boy and back. I'm going to park beneath the statue of Big Boy with his checkered pants and his greasy cowlick like Reagan's. I'm going to admire his rosy cheeks, rounded as buttocks, and walk in to order the minced veal parmesan. I'm going to eat garlic bread until the rich oil runs down my jowls and wipe my hands on dozens of paper napkins, insubstantial as dreams. I am going to think Café Brûlot as I drink a Coke and tip 10%. I am going to drive past Kappelman's Discount Clothes, whistling Vivaldi, and honk at the girls. I am going to circle Our Lady of Perpetual Misery, lit by floodlights, and the crowd queuing up the Red Lobster to gobble surf and turf, and drive past what may be a rapist, humble as Uriah Heep, leaning against a Honda in the outer dark of the parking lot at Sears. I'm going to walk into the Monroeville Mall where George Romero shot Dawn of the Living Dead and admire the heavy ironware and horns, the electric woks and the microwaves, the daisy food strippers, the juice extractors with automatic pulp ejectors, the wherever popcorn poppers, toaster ovens without end, and the kids walking the Walkman around the mall in a Paseo and shoplifting small goods, a bra transparent as our prayers, or palming packs of rubbers with the couple on the package silhouetted by the setting sun. I'm going to admire the toucan in the mall's aviary, his beak the shape of a giant Brazil nut, and be fitted for Harris Tweed and Hughes and Hatcher, where the cretinous salesmen bob and slaver over my big roll of bills. I'm going to chuckle at the basset hound, smoking a pipe in the hush puppy display. She looks like a friend. And I am going to buy chocolate pretzels at the Bavarian Haas. I am going to drive past the Sheraton, more beautiful than any building in Japan. I'm going to follow the rumble and the stink of the garbage trucks into the dawn and think of Camus, how he said he knew with a certainty that our work is nothing but the long journey to recover through the detours of art, the two or three simple great images which first gained access to our hearts. Okay, I have to do this one real quick, and then Joan Bauer is going to come up and get this thing kicked off proper like. Monroeville, PA. One day a kid yelled, "Hey, asshole!" And everybody on the street turned around. Here comes Joan Bauer.
So I'm thrilled to see you all here. Thank you for coming out. A big thank you to Hop Farm, to Herb and Carly, and of course to Chris. This just wouldn't be happening without Chris, let me tell you, no way. And also to Mr. Sturica over here, who's doing the sound and had a tussle with the sound here this evening, but he got it with Scott's help and some other help. They got it all going, so that's really great. I have before me the tip jar. Now, if you were at Hemingway's, you remember that the tip jar was an important part of the evening because we really want to show our appreciation and loyalty to the folks who are here. And so I am going to start it sort of at this over here. And if you could pass it around and put in what you can, I know you may have tipped already for your food, but just a general little thank you. And then somebody could bring it back and put it up there. And I really appreciate that. And a reminder to the poets that we will be doing a photo right after the reading, and there is the open mic, and after the featured readers, we'll take a break so that those of you who want to sign up for that can, and we can buy some books. And I'm just really grateful that we're able to be together, okay? I'm really in a lovely space like this. And whether you are a reader or a writer, it is great to have you all here. As some of you readers will become writers sooner than you think. It's been known to happen. Our first poet tonight is Cameron Barnett. Who is a poet and teacher from Pittsburgh. He is the author of The Drowning Boy's Guide to Water, the winner of the Autumn House Press Rising Writer Prize, and his second full-length book of poetry, Murmur, was published this year and came out from Autumn House Press. His work is really extraordinary, and it does, in fact, explore the complexity of race, place, and relationships for Black people in America and much more. Please welcome Cameron Barnett.
Hello, can you all hear me? All right. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Joan and Chris, as always, for all the work you do for this series and having me a few times now. So much appreciated. Yeah, new book out this year, Murmur. And I'm going to read five poems from this collection. And I think the bio that Joan read actually does a pretty good job introducing my work. There's one poem I'll give some context to, but to start, I'm going to read this poem called A Soft, Indistinct Sound. There's a lot of definitions in this poem, so every time I do this, I'm quoting a definition and the rest is me. A soft, indistinct sound made by a person or group of people speaking quietly. All the glee swept up between decades, echoes of good times stuck in hurricanes of laughter, mistaken for small winds. To make a low, continuous sound. Not every haunting is for horror. Sometimes it's just for company. A softly spoken or almost inaudible utterance. The book of my mother and the book of my father open face to face, pages flipping past each other. To express one's discontent about someone or something in a subdued manner. Between who I am and who I want to be lies an earthquake I cannot hold. The quiet or subdued expression of a particular feeling by a group of people. The redlining of my heart, greater than or equal to the minstrelsy of property value. To say something cautiously and discreetly. Anywhere I go is an interracial space, a fun house of mirrors with all the lights turned off. Booker T's hand stuffed into a boxing glove. A rumor. Beneath the Atlantic lies a massive aquifer of fresh water. Find me here, deep in all the water you cannot see. To say something in a low, soft, or indistinct voice. As much as there are seeds of truth, as much as there is safe soil to hold them, as much as I am my own son downtown. A recurring sound heard in the heart through a stethoscope that is usually a sign of disease or damage. Languid lips dragging over the chest, the cold cup of America listening. This next poem is called Breath, and the only, well, two things to know about it. It's based off a Radiolab episode about hearts when everyone's born and how there is a space in the heart that shuts closed forever that I just found wildly fascinating one day. And the second is I use the word allograph a lot, and if you don't know what allograph means, allograph is basically like a symbol that stands in place of another symbol. And the best way to explain that is like the Roman letter V standing in place of U. So every time you see it, you have to decide in context what it means. So, breath. What I'm saying is blood was never blue, never neatly distinguished nor diagrammed. What I'm saying is that Newton's third law states every prayer has an equal and opposite curse. What I'm saying is that all our hearts once held trap doors that helped us slip past suffocation, but a trap door can only be a trap once. Hallelujah. You were your mother's blood, her body, and yes, her breath. You carry the scar of her love, or as Newton suggests, her pain too. The heart is the only organ we describe with chambers, a place of meeting rooms meant for not meeting. What I'm saying is there was a time we all broke the rules. They want you to forget your first breaths passed through mom's lips. They want you to fall through trapdoors and disappear umbilically. Be it red or blue, your blood is an allograph of inhalation, a synonym, a murmur. What I'm saying is your last breath is the curse of your first, and all the letters of your alphabet belong to the wind, and your mother's wishes, lies, and dreams slip between the chambers of your heart because, whether broken or whole, a promise is an allograph of betrayal. Newton said it himself. That's just science. And the math is clear that our infant hearts have a word problem, hair triggered and primed to slip out beneath us. And by us, I mean them who told you me is we. And I only know that this heartbeat of mine is a simple, persistent knock on the door asking to be let in, to be let out, to be let in again. Black holes. Consider the body. Consider the pulse and pump and thump of life within. You are, in a sense, a sentient sack of plumbing. Consider the body cavernous. A video I watch asks, how many holes does a human have? And it turns out we are not the donut we are so often colloquialized to be. A jar, a cup, a bowl, a plate. Holes only exist if there's a body to host it. The paradox of containment. In the video, I learned that openings aren't holes, just parts of holes. That a straw is one thing with two parts. Consider blackness. Consider the body black, the whole of it sucked through the kinked straw of history, opening to opening. Consider how whole lives were squeezed out of black bodies. Consider the ancestors who prayed for shipwreck, who prayed to be flooded in order to be freed. Consider the weight of what's been kept inside the spaces of our bodies in order to make it. Consider the spaces where our bodies hide, that visibility and invisibility are the same weight double stacked on blackness. Consider the weight of black holes, supermassive ghosts who lurk dark in deep space. They say at the event horizon, a body sucked in would stay frozen in time forever. Not every hole has an exit. Consider chambers and dead ends and their singular openings. Consider black descendants praying for singularity in order to be free of space and time's cruelties. Physicists consider this point so dense that the laws of physics as we know them break down. Black people might not consider this such a bad thing. How long have we prayed for a different physics? Were it not for gravity, we would bend the world wholly. As it turns out, gravity is the weakest force the universe has to offer. As it turns out, the physicists are silent on the force of justice, not even a consideration. Consider blackness, supermassive and free of gravity, bending the arc of the moral universe all the way around until it's whole. This poem is called New Fruit Humming. It's actually a response to a poem in my first book about an ex-girlfriend, and that's all I'll say. I'm here to say sorry, because you definitely said splotchy, because I definitely heard splotchy, because I definitely told everyone about how you said splotchy with your eyes cast down, and everyone said, ain't that some shit? Because who the hell talks about their kids like that? So I'm here to say sorry, because I didn't stay silent. And what I really said was, I know, or yeah, and took a bite of the pear in my hand because we were under an apple tree and you brought pears. And I thought, how strange is this? Never doubting the taste in my mouth, never doubting what I tasted wasn't the flesh of the fruit, never admitting that to you because compromise tasted like oranges. So we just lied and lied and lied. And I've lied about this story before. We weren't in bed because we were definitely under an apple tree, as much as an apple tree can be a bed, and it was definitely hotter than August, though the sun said April, and you said, it just worries me. And now I'm here to say sorry, because I was wrong to believe you were afraid of anything, because my blackness wasn't anything to be afraid of, because my blackness wasn't anything to you. I don't tell people we were under a tree because a bed is a better place to lie or a better place to lay, because I still mix up lane and line, because the story is still so mixed up, I don't know if it even matters, because forgiveness is an act of retelling. And forgiveness is an act of retelling. And forgiveness is an act of retelling. When I think back on that day, I start to cry. Not because I'm sad, but because my left eye and my right eye can't put you together, and it hurts to try because you were so mixed up, because you were so afraid of us mixing, and that's why we were under a tree and not in a bed, and that's why my blackness is afraid of nothing, and that's why it's so hard to lie sometimes. I loved you. And I'd be lying if I said, I'm sorry. You loved me. And now there's new fruit humming in the old fruit tree. Last poem. It's called Ghost Lessons. There are redactions that are blacked out in this, so you'll hear me snap whenever I come across those. My great-great-great-grandmother stares at me in sepia. We both stand in our own classrooms. History has a funny way of being a hallway, an isthmus, a, or sometimes a thimble, covering what hopes to avoid piercing. How do you hold a family together? Pin this. Portia would flourish her hands in bidwist to show off her friends, diamonds on different fingers. What hands can hold is often all that's passed on, often. My grandmothers pulled thread through Pittsburgh, master seamstresses, their hands stitching steel through cloth, white passing palms and soft pulses beneath skin, which can be a thimble itself if you let the pin pricks and teach you. I have learned teaching is a thing of the blood. Dad taught me when to tuck my tongue in my pocket, when to listen. When they speak, my elders drop A's from their days, so it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Ancestry is one giant game of telephone echoed through tin can decades. Pin this. Porky hiding happiness deep in his dimples. Pin this. Spoogey and Pigeon took the yellow boat out in L.A., and the sea nearly took them. A name is a story, and Dad taught me not to tell all my stories at once. Then we both forgot. I remind myself there's, in remembrance, a heaven all around me. A ghost of mine is colorblind when it looks out at the world. A ghost of mine is colorblind when it looks at itself. What right do I have to play the prism? My matriarchs pulled legacy through eyes of steel, and still so many people in my family have tried or failed or succeeded at leaving this land. Sometimes I almost believe I understand. Pin this. The Barnetts backstitched love into this land to make sure I'd always feel held, even when I knit negativity out of whole cloth or search for purpose in my pinpricks. My grandmother's new needles pull more than thread. I'm searching their patterns for all the lessons of ancestry left behind. How to mend your heart. How to be a better man. How to be black. How black to be. How to write the story of yourself. Thank you.
Wow, thank you so much, Cameron. Thank you. Thank you. Christina Fasanik is the editor or author of more than 30 books, including the memoir, The Optimistic Food Addict and Digital Storytelling as Public History, with co-author Robert Stakely. She is passionate about the history of her hometown, Wheeling, West Virginia, which is the subject of an upcoming collection of essays pulling the thread, untangling, wheeling history. When not right making art, Dr. Fsanek is a professor of English at Penn West, the president of the Writers Association of Northern Appalachia, and co-host of WANA Live. And it is really great to have, this is the first time she's read it, Hemingway's. And so we're thrilled to have her here. Please welcome Christina.
Is this a good height? Can you hear me, everybody? Thank you, Joan, for being the only person who's ever introduced me and got my last name pronounced correctly. I appreciate that very much. And even people will ask me, how is it, and I'll pronounce it, and they'll come up and they'll mispronounce it. So I really appreciate that. And thank you for having me here, and thank you, Chris. And this is an awesome venue. It's amazing. So tonight I'm going to read from a novel in progress that I'm working on right now called American Glass. And before I tell you a little bit about that, I just wanted to thank the Mad Women of the Attic. I'm in this 30-week-long fiction writing class with Keely Bauer, and it's amazing, and we're having a great time, and I'm working on this novel in there. Normally I write nonfiction, creative and otherwise, so this is a departure for me, but it's so fun because it is historical fiction. So I can still do things like research and write about stuff that actually happened, but now I get to play with it and make stuff happen that didn't happen. So I'm enjoying that. So this novel, American Glass, takes place in Moundsville, West Virginia, and you might not think that you know where that is, but I bet you do, because it has the largest conical Native American burial mound east of the Mississippi River on one side of the street, and a condemned West Virginia State Penitentiary on the other. So I always tell people I'm from death on both sides. So anyways, it takes place at Fostoria Glass, which no longer exists, but it did for almost 100 years. And my grandmother, Jean, who this novel is about, it's like based on her life, her real life, and her grandmother and her mother were all glass workers there. And so in many ways, this is an homage to her and her grandmother and her mother. But it's also a novel about unionizing. When we meet Jean in this chapter, she's 21 years old, so still young and still trying to figure out who she is. And she's going to her first union meeting. And later in the novel, she becomes very radicalized and starts fighting really hard, especially for women that work at the glass house. I also want to add that when I refer to the glory hole in this novel, I'm talking about this large furnace where glass would be molten at about 2,000 degrees. And so, different historians have talked about why did they call it the glory hole, and part of it was that they said it looked like you were going to either heaven or hell, staring in this pit of molten glass. And so this is a chapter from that novel and a work in progress. Despite late February ice climbing the glass of the assembly hall windows, it was hotter than blue hell inside. Close to 400 Fostoria workers had filled the wooden folding chairs for a joint meeting of American Flint Glass Workers, Union Locals 10 and 507. They were all stripped of their coats, and many of them had rolled up their work shirt sleeves. Some of the women were blotting their sweaty faces with cotton handkerchiefs, trying to retain at least some of the faces they put on that morning. Mary Willis had just started speaking when Jean walked in and found her seat in the back row alongside Blanche Ovies, Doris Wright, Bessie Pavlak, Joyce Durham, and Betty Clark. They had all become fast friends in the past couple of years. Jean took off her burgundy wraparound and flopped herself down, propping her Mary Janes on the rail of the chair in front of her. "What I miss?" she asked in more than a whisper. Blanche leaned across Doris and said, "I don't know, some business about fair wages, but I don't think that has anything to do with us lowly sorters." Jean nodded and sat quietly for a few minutes, trying to adjust to the nearly intolerable heat. Apparently, the fan limit control switch on the furnace was out again, and they were waiting on a part to come in from Akron, Ohio. At least that's what Bessie whispered in Jean's left ear. Lord, it's hot as a devil's rear end in here, Jean said, her voice carrying up the rows of sweaty flints, some of whom glared back at her impatiently, while her friends covered their mouths with slick palms to suppress the laughter. You're going to get us kicked out of here, Jean, Betty warned as she tried to put on a more serious face. They can't kick us out. By God, we're dues-paying members, she said. That sent the women over the edge, and their giggles erupted the stifling thrum of the meeting. Jean looked away from her mirthful buddies just in time to catch Mary's eyes trained on her. The vice president shook her head slightly, and Jean, embarrassed, whispered down the row, "Come on, girls, we better give it a listen." John Hardgrove was talking about the upcoming union convention to be held at Atlantic City. We're sending all four of our officers to represent both unions. If you have concerns that you'd like to raise with the leadership, please come up and let us know. A hand shot up in the middle of the third row. Yes, Denise, John said. Do you think you can put a stop to the building of the medic station in the glory hole? You know it's going to cost me my job, and it's just me and my little girls. I can't go back to my cold metal salary, she said in a firm and measured tone. Denise Bungard had moved into hot metal in 1944 and developed a reputation as a skilled glassblower. Her husband Danny had been killed in Okinawa, and she was left to raise their three daughters on her own. Now, Denise, John began, I think you know that no one wants you to lose your jobs or your wages, but this medic station could save lives in hot metal. You know, we've got to think about, Mary interrupts. I assure you, Denise, that we are still discussing ways to avoid demoting your girls in hot metal and bullshit, shouts a man's voice from the left corner of the sweltering hall. You want to keep risking our health and well-being for a bunch of skirts? The crowd buzzed with the sound of disgruntled voices. Yeah, do you think the men in the hole should be denied medical treatment or something? Another male voice added from somewhere in the middle of the room. Jean and her crew had quieted down by this point, but were still fidgeting, not really understanding what everyone was crowing about. She looked up at row after row of co-workers, many with wide sweat patches on their backs of their work shirts, and tried to make sense of what was happening. You listen to me, Denise said, now standing, twisted to face the back of the room, her flax-brown hair limp with sweat. I risk my life every shift in hot metal just like you. Last June, I got sent home early from a burn on my right arm. Don't think I don't get it. But I deserve to keep my job just as much as any of you men. We women kept stepping aside to let you have your jobs back now that the war is over, but enough is enough. She put her hands on her hips to emphasize her point and stood defiantly as the rumble of voices grew louder. Then John spoke. Well, I think you've made your point loud enough. Could you take your seat? After a second or two, Denise did just that by plopping in her chair. I assure you all, Mary said, we will do our best to work this out. We want everybody to be safe, but we don't want people to lose their jobs. More grumbling from the crowd. John, holding his chin in his hand, raised his eyebrows in doubtfulness, but said nothing. Jean whispered to Betsy, I don't think that's right. You know, those women losing their jobs? Just because they have to take out the ladies' room for the medic station? That doesn't even make sense, does it? Bessie shrugged and continued dabbing her damp forehead with her hanky. Listen, we have more business to get to, and we need to do it before this heat takes us all out, John said, interrupting what had become a free-for-all. Let's get to it. Jean spent the rest of the meeting thinking about these women who took the most difficult jobs in the factory to keep the business going while the men were off at war. And now they're losing their jobs because they are taking out their bathroom? She had gotten used to women workers being displaced as the men returned to claim what they had left behind, but this seemed to be entirely unnecessary. She was damn sick of being a second-class citizen. She had spent her childhood watching her grandmother and her mom drag their weary bodies to and from the glass house. She knew they worked just as hard as any man did and then went home to take care of their families to boot. They deserved the same pay and the right to keep their jobs. She looked up from her reverie As the room full of overheated workers began to rise and head out the tall double doors into the frigid afternoon. Her girlfriends were putting on their coats and giggling about something Jean had missed. She tried to join in on the fun, but couldn't stop thinking about how awful it would be to try to get by on a pay cut if she was caring for her family. Eventually, she shrugged and put on her coat, leaving it undone in the miserable heat as she followed her crew out into the street. Jean caught her breath in surprised exhilaration as the blast of cold air hit her chest and face as she walked down the assembly hall steps and onto the sidewalk. She shivered pleasantly as she tied her wrap around her waist. "Well, girls, we've got 20 minutes before our shift starts," she said. "Want to go for a cuppa?" And just like that, Jean was back at it, striding the few blocks down the street to Mitchell's to have coffee and maybe a bit of bread pudding with the girls before heading back over for her shift. Thank you.
Yes. Yes. Solidarity. Yes. Yes. Our next reader is Shannon Sankey, the author of We Ran Rapturous, published in 2019. She holds an MFA in poetry and pedagogy from Chatham University, and I love this part, where she was the Margaret Whitford Fellow. She is the recipient of a 2017 Academy of American Poets University and College Prize and a 2019 SAFTA residency, and she was selected for Best Poets 2019. This is Shannon's first time reading for the Hemingway series. We're so happy to have her. Please welcome Shannon Sankey.
Hey, thank you so much, Joan and Chris, and everything that you guys do for poetry in the city. It's so such an honor to read for the great Hemingway series for the first time. All right, I'm working on some new stuff. It's all about grief. Sorry in advance. this is bird feed. I bought my dad a bird feeder with a Wi-Fi enabled camera. We downloaded the app to our phones and connected everything. In a couple of months, I could recognize faces. The cardinal always comes first. I can tell a house sparrow from a song sparrow. In an unrelated dream, I select a sensible casket for someone. When the camera captures my dad tipping out more sunflower seeds in the cold, I save the file to my phone. He prefers the woodpeckers, downy or red-bellied, but I feel something for the purple finches and the round junco. I think about getting in the Allegheny under the bridge where the garlic mustard chokes the swamp rose, but then what? I hate to be cold. When the white-breasted nuthatch came, I felt it was a reward for my grace. And the problem with that is sometimes you pick up the phone and you can't have your medication anymore. And what did you do to deserve that? My dad's backyard is peculiar in the live feed. The lens casts down weakly on the row of duplexes. The sun sets red in total distortion. The motion sensor can detect the delicate leg of a city doe two doors down or a Carolina wren on the ground, where many times I imagined my life would be one way or the other. Now, my dad says the birds sing when they see him. It seems to me they never stop. I've been reading a lot of Szymborska lately because I find her work really generative for prompts. And it turns out she has a poem called Plotting with the Dead. It's just a series of questions that I decided to answer. So this is after Plotting with the Dead. Szymborska asks after my dead. Under what conditions do you dream of the dead? Often, in the late morning hours in November, at the pitch of a fever, with my finger in an odd book, in a room of observation. But this time, I was alone in a great white hall. It was the night before my wedding. I was awake. I was dressing 24 round tables with green velvet linens. I had to gather and toss the tablecloth across the broad diameter and walk the circumference of each table three times, stooping to pull the fabric evenly beneath the vinyl chairs. Like in church, the kneeling had finally made me sick. My mother was in the hospital again. I sunk down to finish my job and went blind. Then, busy blue shapes dawned around me. 12 women sitting on their heels, fussing seriously with the tablecloths, shifting weight from hip to hip in quiet cooperation. What do they hold in their hands? I brought myself to stand and watch as the dead went about fixing my shoddy work. My grandmother and my aunt, their bare knees and fleshy arms touching each other again in a shared task, their long fingers worrying the room into perfect order. And who's behind them? Weren't these the mothers of my dearest friends looking down familiar noses at their work, their names given to me, Mendy, Debbie, Teeny, stone fruits from another place? And in their eyes, what? I recognized mothers I found in the ground, too. Carolyn with her long braid and house dress, then Etta, then Carrie, then Eliza. Do they say where they come from? It seemed immaterial whether I might have called them up out of secret chemistry for comfort, apportioning myself to each image like water into a row of glasses, or whether I was briefly seeing sideways into the place where time keeps our mothers, who sit on their heels for us in intercession. What do you reply? I understood the argument against my abandonment and said nothing. I've written exactly one COVID poem. This is it. Safe smoke. It's spring again. Tonight, I can hear the soprano cantata of chorus frogs from the pond behind our house. Do you remember when we waited at the window all winter for an ice rink? When we watched the morgue trucks fill up on our phones? And then we went into mourning in warm coats to try the ice. I took the milking stool you made by hand, the one I used to clip your hair in the yard and pull up purple radishes for breakfast. We laced two pairs of old skates, and I taught you footwork from my lessons, and we laughed the vultures out of the redbud trees. I watched for your breath then, made plain to me in the cold light. It was the safe smoke I drew on every night of that terrible year. This is Conversation with the Wind. We bought a kite for $7 and climbed the hill. So what? Our parents disappointed us. You lifted the kite to your face and the wind accepted it without trouble. You ran then, tossing your jacket, tugging at the line so the kite pitched and pulled higher. We were laughing. It was floating. It was funny. Sometimes the wind ripped at the kite, wrenching it suddenly sideways. Sometimes the wind abandoned the kite in a dopey freefall and snatched it up at last before it sliced the green, sending us tripping over the pursuit of levity. Once I became the kite on the line. It was terrifying, and you wound me down. The long tails chattered in the light, and the light made our eyes wet and dull. I wandered away to make you a mouse bouquet of spring beauty and ragwort. Bittercress exploded into seed under my shoes. The afternoon turned out not to be an adversary. I remembered my mother would die. I knew I would live and sometimes love to. You brought the kite in from the sky, and the grackle shimmered in its place. After an hour, the conversation was over. Just two more for you. Solstice. Yesterday, the light was long, and we stood to consider it at the window. The neighbor's barn was 30 blues in quick succession. Then it was over with. I thought of each of my dead. Our houseplants shook and drew breath imperceptibly. If they signaled some message to one another, it had probably nothing to do with us. Once again, thanks so much. This is my last one. Poem ending with a line from Wang Wei. A certain mood sometimes befell my dead aunt when she was alive. She could, she said, sense the spirit of her late husband embodied by her cat. Having never met the man, I took the cat's face in my hands and told him hello. No, she said, embarrassed. It's not all of the time. My concern now is, does or does not the robin regard me? I watch a moth from a boat with my mouth open, which is a kind of keening. I name the lizard on the woodpile, beach plum, come here. The firefly on my car door is on an errand, and maybe it's nothing to do with me, but the green spider making useless work out of my hair, so-and-so, even he could be one of my dead, my somebody baby. It is not sad to go out into the field. Why do you ask? The field is crowded. It is sad to walk in the house and shut the door. Thanks again.
Wow, Shannon. It is so thrilling to hear a new poet. Oh, geez, it's so great. Thank you. Our next reader is Jason Irwin, the author of 3 full-length poetry collections, most recently, The History of Our Vagrancies. In 2002, he was Zoglossia Fellow and part of the Poetry Foundation's Disability Poetics Project. His nonfiction has been published in Santa Ana Review, Panorama, The Catholic Worker, and City of Asylum, Pittsburgh, Live Ability, Encounters in Poetry and Prose Project. Jason, as you might have heard, grew up in Dunkirk, New York, and he is really one of my favorite poets in Pittsburgh. Please welcome Jason Irwin.
Hello, and thanks for coming out. Thanks, Joan, Chris. I'm going to read some prose. I'm not a prose writer, but I've been working on a memoir for 5 years, and it's driving me nuts. So first thing I'm going to read is the first chapter, and it's about my mother, and this chapter takes place 3 days before she died. It's called Get This Body Out of Here, January 25th, 2019. Jay, Jay, my mother howled from the back bedroom. I woke and ran in to find her coiled in a fetal position at the foot of her bed. You better get this body out of here, she commanded. I died an hour ago. I was about to reach out to touch her, to brush her hair away from her face and try to calm her. Instead, I pulled back and stood staring at what she'd become. Purple veins, like dried up tributaries, spread across the sallow topography of her chest. The twin peaks of her clavicle threatened to puncture her skin with each labored breath. Her dark doe eyes held me in their watery gaze, boring into me, feral and pleading. What are you talking about? I snapped. You're not dead. Instantly, I realized how bothered I sounded, how annoyed. My mother was dying, and all I was worried about was getting enough sleep and that I had to go to work in a couple of hours. 6 months earlier, before we had any inkling my mother was ill, my partner Jenny and I made a 3-hour trip from Pittsburgh to Dunkirk, New York, to spend the weekend with her. It was July, a couple weeks before my 47th birthday. My mother was feeling good, so we decided to go for a drive. The air smelled of fresh-cut grass, wildflowers, and diesel. Vineyards rose and fell to our right, while on the left, the cement-gray waters of Lake Erie passed in and out of view like the back of a whale. My mother rolled her window down and let the wind sweep across her face while Bob Dylan crooned from the CD player, "Someday, baby, you ain't gonna worry about me anymore." We drove through Silver Creek and the Seneca Reservation to Athol Springs, where we sat outside on a restaurant patio overlooking the lake, the Buffalo and Lackawanna skylines in the distance. A flock of white windmills stood on the shore where, when I was a child, the mills of Bethlehem steel towered and spewed dark fumes of smoke and grime. Jenny and my mother ordered porterhouse steak with mashed potatoes, while I had walleye, coleslaw, and fries. My mother and I posed for a photograph, our shoulders leaning into one another, our smiles wide. 2 years before that summer day, my mother suffered a stroke. We were in the habit of talking on the phone at least 3 times a day, sometimes more. I called her during my lunch break and while walking to the bus stop after work. She called to tell me what was happening in Dunkirk, what she'd heard on the news, and to remind me it was my turn to play at Scrabble. Yet she waited 2 days before mentioning that she might have had a stroke. It was a Friday in May. I called several times, but she didn't answer. The day before, she sounded groggy, a bit confused. She told me she had a terrible headache and was going to bed. "You can call me later," she said, "but I might not answer." When she finally did answer, about 3:30 the following afternoon, her voice slurred. "I think I had a stroke," she said. "Last night? No, Wednesday." I hung up and called the Dunkirk police. That night, I drove to Erie, Pennsylvania, where she had been taken by ambulance to Hammett Hospital. My mother had suffered an ischemic stroke due to a buildup of plaque in her carotid arteries. Even though she hadn't received immediate care, care that may well have prevented her from losing the use of her left arm, she was lucky. Her mind wasn't affected. She remained sharp and quick-witted as ever. Even her sarcasm was intact. Doctors put a stent in one of her arteries and released her after a few days. They suggested she go to rehab, but my mother refused. She was adamant about going home to her apartment. With the help of a walker, a home health aide, and an unyielding determination, she managed to live on her own a few more years, hiding behind a facade of independence and fearlessness. Now my mother was truly dying, and all I could do was watch her die. She moved in with us 3 weeks earlier, leaving her beloved apartment in the town she grew up in behind. That summer day along the lake seemed a lifetime ago. As I stood over her, the early morning sky outside the window, transforming from black to a dull chrome, I watched my mother watching me, then tried to turn away, embarrassed and frightened by my sudden outburst of anger and the truth I refused to accept. Images of Kafka's Hunger Artist flashed in my mind and I grew dizzy. Everything moved in slow motion, distorted somehow, like we were being pulled by some centrifugal force. It was how I'd felt as a child on the operating table when the doctor put the ether mask over my mouth and the lights grew so bright I thought their radiance might swallow me. "Get this body out of here," she yelled. Had she been dreaming? Had the cancer spread to her brain? There were signs, but maybe I ignored them. Now she was convinced that she had already died and her corpse left before her on the bed. "You're not dead," I said, as if trying to convince myself. "Take my pulse, then." I took her hand in mine and pressed my finger to her wrist where the vein bulged. "Well," she said, as if she knew the answer. When I admitted I couldn't find a pulse, she smirked. It was a look that she'd given on nights in my 20s when I'd come home drunk, insisting I'd only had a beer or two. A look that says, "Who do you think you're talking to? I'm your mother, remember?" It was a look that said, "See, I told you so." Thank you. And this chapter takes place in 1980, so it just goes back and forth in time. This is called Blaze of Glory. Music could always be heard in our house. Before the oldies station on my mother's TV, there were records, LPs and 45s that my parents listened to. We used to have a small turntable that looked like a suitcase, which sat on the wall-length bookshelf in my father's study. He even ran one of the speaker wires through the drop ceilings into the bathroom so my mother could listen to music while she took a shower. I remember sitting on the floor watching my parents dance to Chubby Checker's The Twist, their bodies bending and gyrating as Checker called out, "Round and round and up and down we go," like a shaman, beckoning them to partake in this ritual of body and soul, while Joe Macho's bass kept the beat and Georgie Young burped arpeggios on the sax. After my father moved out, my mother transformed his study into a music room. Gone were his roll-top desk, his commemorative plate from the televangelist Oral Roberts, a framed picture of a chimp dressed in a three-piece suit. Gone were his stock charts that looked like EKG readings. Gone were his lottery magazines and thick tomes on economics, all of which he studied like scripture. In their place, my mother dragged the tattered yellowed love seat from the living room. She hung a poster of Elvis and a painting of Jesus exposing his sacred heart. She opened the curtains, hung spider plants and ferns in the bay window, and sprayed something that smelled like the lilac tree in our backyard. During this time, it had become my job to wake my mother each morning so she could help me get ready for school. Her clock radio went off at 7:15 a.m., and I'd hobble into her bedroom. The clock was only a few inches from her head on the nightstand, but it could have been down the street, for she never heard it. "Mom, it's time to get up," I'd shout. 5 more minutes, she'd beg, her eyes momentarily springing open. Then she'd turn over, pull the covers over her head, and groan, "Please, just give me 5 more minutes." I'd press the snooze button and run into the kitchen, turn on the Mr. Coffee Maker, and then make her toast slathered with butter and powdered cinnamon. One December morning, I hobbled into my mother's bedroom and called her as usual. Instead of pressing the snooze button, I stood and listened to the radio announcer, who sounded as if he'd been crying. "John Lennon was assassinated outside his apartment in New York City last night," he said. He was 40 years old. I had no idea who this guy Lennon was, but the word "assassinated" filled me with a mix of fear and excitement. It sounded so adult, so cool. All that day and for the next few weeks, the radio and TV were abuzz about him and his band, the Beatles. The accused killer, Mark David Chapman, was a Beatles fan who flew all the way from Hawaii just to shoot Lennon. They said 2 bullets struck the left side of Lennon's back and 1 lodged in his aorta, virtually destroying the major blood vessels above his heart on impact. A week later, my cousin and Aisha watched the televised memorial service. Thousands of people had gathered outside the Dakota. They stood crying and singing Lennon songs, "Give Peace a Chance" and "Imagine." As with the film The Lincoln Conspiracy, which a few years earlier, I begged my mother to take me to, wanting only to witness Lincoln's brains fly out of his head like a horror movie, I became obsessed with the gory details of Lennon's murder and often dreamed of being assassinated myself. These bloody fantasies filled my waking dreams, and I often found myself narrating the story of my own death. "Irwin was found riddled with bullets," my reporter's voice said in front of the bathroom mirror, or "the killer attacked Irwin with a hatchet." Was I psychotic? Was my obsession with being murdered some kind of internalized martyr complex that I learned from my mother? Did it foreshadow, along with my bloody magic marker drawings of Jesus being crucified, or the G.I. Joe figures that I cut up and set fire to, some future violence? Or was I no different from other boys my age who'd fallen in love with death, or at least the idea of it? I also became obsessed with everything Lennon and the Beatles, and found a copy of Revolver among my mother's record collection, hidden between Elvis and Barry Manilow. Even though I couldn't articulate how, I knew that everything in my life had changed. It was as if with Lennon's death, I was reborn, and my destiny had been revealed. I no longer wanted to be a firefighter, the quarterback for the Buffalo Bills, or Rocky Balboa. I'd be a rock star one day and go down in a blaze of glory. What else? Why else had I been born? Why else had I survived so many hospitalizations and surgeries? Thank you.
One more. Byron Hoot was born and raised in Morgantown, West Virginia, and he lived there until he went to college, a 12-year excursion. Never returned to West Virginia, but he never left it. He now lives in northwestern Pennsylvania, still in Appalachia, continuing his work as a published poet. His work has appeared in Rattle, Watershed Journal, Tobacco, Literary Arts Journal, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He is the co-founder of the, Tamarack? Tamarack Writers and the Fernwood Writers Retreat. His most recent book is Poems of a Mad Hunter and Other Tales. And to give you any... Given any opportunity, he will read a poem about a bear. But maybe he won't be doing that tonight. Who knows? Please, and this is his first time reading for the Hemingway series. Please welcome Byron Hoot.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege to read. 50 years of reading poetry, it's no small accomplishment. I'll be reading from four selections tonight, two poems apiece. The first one comes from an upcoming work called Sitting Moon, Morning Twilight, which will be published by Quigsby, Pickford and Cheshire, publisher and editor Ray Bugay, back in the right hand corner, my friend and primary irritant. And it's a four volume set. It comes from my daily practice, which is writing every day. So we're taking a year and dividing it into four sections. So these first two poems represent some of that. It's called The Return. The mist rose from patches of pines like prayer incense rising, disappearing as words thin and the burden of the prayers dissolved until there was only the scent of pine and the air was cleared for response. It took all day for the answers to appear. Hours of driving in the congestion of speed and slowdowns, of cars and trucks and semis, feet from front and back bumpers. And then that thin, some 2 hours from home, as I drove west into the grandeur of the sunset, mauve clouds with gray underlines, pink patches mixed with wisps of white, the sun slipping behind the clouds in that evening glow of gold, and felt the answers to the unspeakable morning prayers, and knew I'd soon be home. Second one is Overtaken. The season is taking me. The change of energy begins to run through me. That loss into splendor colors of leaves and sky, the longer gloamings, the longer nights, the cooler air until winter says, I'm here. That clothed beauty disrobing unabashedly, seducing dreams and seeking that clarion call to change. Who does not love the change of one season into another? Who does not love love? That beauty of change life suckles us with, that call of the wild, that refrain, I am with you always. I've been doing these Grendel poems for 40 plus years. I did my master's thesis on John Gardner. The second book I read by him was Grendel. So, you know, that is the Beowulf story told from the monster's perspective. I notched it up a little bit. Hrothgar and Grendel are twin brothers. So it's a little different story. This is called The Problem. Hrothgar, the cry for me from the women in deep dreams of desire drive their husbands mad. The question of dream and reality becomes a backhanded answer, each given to each, one as a question, one as an answer. And the piercing look at children, the searching eye of recognition of what is or what is not recognized, fall on everyone, everything. Yet Willio keeps silent, keeps her moans inside, and you have no idea what your thanes complain about, laugh at their discomfort. And she smiles sitting by your side, and you think you share a private joke when it is she who has been shared. At first, she thought it was you. Then one night whispered Grendel. Things changed. She sometimes calls your name as if the monster and the king are the same she gives herself to. You are brothers, she whispers. And I laugh softly, say, tell no one. She sighs. She sits content. Your thanes discontent. And sometimes I see a slow fog of suspicion arise in your eyes, and then the downward sweep of your hand that dismisses what you think impossible. I am your brother, and you married for the kingdom's sake, and the body and the heart will not indulge that rape and will seek who is needed to satisfy what convenience and kingdom building cannot. I am that satisfaction. Outcast, outlaw, monster, brother to you, the parts you have forgotten, I have honed to an art that makes her long for me. Words, poetry, listening, and yes, that touch, that tangle of body saying what no words can. You've got a problem, brother, and it's me. My end. I have seen my end, and it is endless. The dream was real, or time and eternity, and me are on the next page. Where time and eternity and me are braided together and forever. The fire sniveling dragon's words of my untimely death. As you have killed, so you will die, as useless as a twig against a flood. The intimations the shaper sings from fantasies of my ending as unreal as a priest's prayer for deliverance from me. I have seen forever in the dangling arm of a hero as monstrous as I am, blood pouring out of his shoulder, shouting my name like an old man trying to get hard for a young woman, and I saw and felt the peace to come at the end of my reign, at the uttermost, as my uttermost enemy is vanquished, and sighed as if in the afterglow of making love, falling into that pleasure forever, where desire and time conspire in the hills of eternity by streams that never flood. I, Grendel, have seen this true dream, though slightly haunted by how many other dreams have turned out false. How right the dragon and shaper have been, how I have seen what has never been seen. I shake my head, await that hero whose death shall be life to me. These next two poems come from a manuscript called West Virginia Revisited. Born and raised in West Virginia. My father was a minister, so there are religious references here in these next few poems. I am that son of a preacher, man, and all the congregation was responsible for my wonderful wicked behavior. This is called On the Back of a Snake. It was Route 119 that took us to the church campgrounds, a snake of a road, and looking back, I'm not certain it wasn't a live snake's back we rode. The hairpin curves, the steep climbs, the dangerous descents into valleys where too much speed could leave us against the mountainside, as if the road was trying to get us off its back. And then we'd arrive, pass under the arch, onto the gravel streets where cabins and dormitories and a kitchen hall and a tabernacle stood among trees, tall oaks and hemlocks and maples, where men and women called each other brother and sister with ease. It was a gathering of the tribe, the names of churches by the towns and cities and lakes and hollows and valleys, the names of the bands. I was too young to know what a smile can hide, reveal. Besides, it was a place of knife games and stolen kisses and practicing saying, I love you in utter ignorance, a time of being saved, backsliding, forgiveness, one more kiss. In dreams, I sometimes remember the names and lips of girls I kissed, held, caressed, made promises I knew, and she knew too, not to be kept. Later, I heard the doors, the line, ride the snake to the lake, to the ancient lake, baby, and knew that was the one I had ridden on called Route 119. Stripped. Coal mines, strip mines, lumber mills, fracking, all promises of prosperity, a promise given but kept for those who did not do the work, did not breathe the air, cough, have trees fall on them, live in company houses, buy from company stores, have dreams turn into nightmares of loss. Those who could not leave were forced and stayed in a longing reserve for the damned in hell. So this too was the landscape I grew in. The lies father and mothers told children, things will get better. The truth that left no sleep. These ghosts walked with me, still do. More real the older I get. And yet, always and yet, where heart and soul survive, where beauty still abides, where stories inspire in spite of time and circumstance, where to say, I was born and raised in West Bog God, Virginia, means something, something more than can be said. Hardship and beauty and love never far from each other. I know that Trinity well. The last two poems come from a manuscript called That Time. As I said, my father was a minister. He pastored fairly large churches in West Virginia in the Church of the Nazarene. When I was 8, he resigned from church because of church politics and became an evangelist. And I don't know how many of you know what an evangelist really is. It's not a TV evangelist. These are preachers who go from small town to small town holding revivals, 4 days, 5 days, 6 days, 7 days. It went from 7 days to 4 days to 3 days in my father's lifetime. I guess people were more holy the older he got. But this is about a time when we moved from Huntington back to Morgantown where he had pastored. It's a triptych. The first section, there are three sections. The first one is called June, who's the mother and wife. The second one is called Cub, the husband and father. And the third one is called Henry, the boy. So this is about 10 poems to each section. These two poems are June's first two poems. And just a preface. My father used to say when we first moved into this house, the house was so small you had to go outside to put your hand in your pocket. And he was not far from the truth. Being a preacher and all, you know. I didn't think it was so small. Recalling the parsonage, left the three bedrooms, the hardwood floors, the brick house, the concrete patio. Cub took the skeleton key from his pocket, unlocked the door, stepped in. I stumbled. I felt sick. Started seeing the furniture in the rooms. A kitchen of sorts, two bedrooms. A living room of sorts. No plumbing. Not yet. An outhouse, well water, a basement. What have you done? I glared at him. He looked away. God, I began, caught between a curse and a prayer. What, he asked. I looked at him. He's putting an addition on. Kitchen, bathroom, indoor plumbing. It has a nice porch, he said. I walked by him so he wouldn't see me cry. 2. It was hard that first time, those first 10 days he was gone. Maybe one phone call, a letter always starting, "My dearest June." Henry was 8. I brought him into bed with me so I wouldn't cry. Maybe to have a warm body beside me, as much for him as for me. A part answer to, "When's Dad coming back?" And the answer that wore the question away, and we picking him up at the Greyhound terminal, or driving to pick him up. And then I put Henry into his own bed. I lost the fear of crying, of sleeping alone. I waited for that phone call, that letter. I listened hard, tried to see between the lines, knew by the way he kissed me. The only thing he had was the question he would not ask, would God provide? I'm glad he never asked me that. I don't know what I would have said. Thank you.
Stay where you are. Okay, there. Thank you. Well, that was just great. That was so wonderful. Such different voices. Oh, thank you. And I want to just let you know before we take our break and we do the photo and we encourage you to stay for the open mic. We give those of you a chance to sign up for the open mic if you would like, that our readers next time, which will be on Tuesday, June the 11th, they will be Valerie Bachrach, Doralee Brooks, Sherry Flick, Don Wentworth, and Stephanie Vilkoben. Whom I heard read for the first time a couple of days ago, and she is a remarkable poet. Just a wonder. So thrilling to hear her, and we'll get her name straight by then, I'm pretty sure. But thank you all for being here. But hey, don't leave. Because there are books for sale. If the poets and writers would like to bring their books up here so people can buy some, and if the poets would also come up here to have the photo done, poets and writers, and we'll take a little break. And then the open mic last time was so good. It was really, really good. So, hey, stay for that. Okay, thanks so much.
Hello, hello. Okay, we're going to get this open mic thing started. So if everyone could take their seats or grab their beers, grab their books. Thanks again, everybody coming out. What a great reading. We're off to a really, really good start in our new home. I hope you guys like it here. We do. So you like it? Good, good. Okay, here we go. There are a lot of people on here without last names, so who knows? I have no idea who they are, because they won't tell us. They're secret writers. So we're going to start the open mic with Chuck L. Chuck, where's Chuck? All right, here we go, Chuck.
So I'll enter and sign in, please. My last name is Lanigan, now you know. All right. So I got a couple of pieces here. I've gotten involved with Pittsburgh Poetry Exchange in the past year, and I was at their anniversary event, and I ran into Joan and got a notice of our little event here. So I thought I'd show up, because you're down the street from me in Morningside. All right, two pieces, one-pagers. Trigger warning. There's rhyme in these. Suspending disbelief, written while traveling, because I came back from Costa Rica recently. You must suspend disbelief in that the wisdom of crowds will transform your life in the power of clouds for a new and improved day free of strife, sanitized for your convenience, that she's on the pill. That he'll come back to you because he loves you still, and going on vacation will give you both back the thrill. That it's one day at a time, that one size fits all, and the dress you're wearing will make you the belle of the ball. That one little pill will restore your confidence, and the world we have made will finally make sense. That a 30-day money-back guarantee will set us free. That love will find you, because it's meant to be. That it's all good, and we never suffer more than we can stand. That God holds the world in the palm of his hand, and the gods whom we worship will make no demand, that the plane you are taking will return safely to land. Thank you. Number two, modernization and monetization. You hijacked my phone, filled it with detritus, come-ons from the ether, occupied my laptop with squatter's rights. Monitor what I do at night, where I shop, what I look for at every store, whom I pine and sigh for. When I seek solace for my loneliness and grief, you send me secrets of healthy aging, six-pack abs, stronger erections, to satisfy a woman every time for the price of one thin dime. While outside the world lies raging at our door, you convince me I must buy more. Is it a losing proposition that we must assume the position bending to the will of some invisible hand with its fingers in the till, rather than take a stand for a liberated land where some things are still free? Air and love and sunshine to warm us in the winter, and the secrets of our soul shared only with a few who choose to know us. Thank you.
Okay, next up we have one of my favorite names. It's my daughter's name. Joni. Where are you at, Joni? Come on up.
Hi, my name's Joni Stamford. I'm a mental health therapist and a mindfulness teacher, and I like to write poetry. So I'm going to share two poems. This first one is called The Inside Story. I longed for some deep, safe haven, a place where I could shelter from life's noise and storms and heartaches. Seeking something physical, the cover of a shade tree, trust, a warm blanket to wrap into, belief, the arms of another who could block out the world, if only for moments of now, love. That safe haven eluded me. I heard the story that maybe I wasn't worthy. I wondered, as I gazed into the deep woods, what lurked in the shadows. As I grew closer to the darkness, I found only myself, my fear, my past dragging behind. Hidden under the brush, amongst the twigs and behind the tallest trees, I found remnants, pieces of who I am, who I long to be, and the fear of getting exactly what I want. Deeper still, I found something more beautiful than I ever imagined. The path to the safe haven is never clear. It's riddled with stones and ditches and muddy spots. It curves and it bends, and sometimes I lost my way. Sometimes I learned I must take a chance on faith. Faith, not something external, not something mystical. Faith is in me. It's in you. Deep in the woods is a safe haven of faith, of a love that runs fluid and free, of a love that roots into the earth and reaches for the sky. Love. It's the inside story, hidden by the wet, muddy earth, the fallen branches, the sweet scent of pines, the critters scurrying about and the birds calling overhead. In our blind spot, filled by the mind with more noise, there actually lives a stillness, a safe haven of trust, a deep, ever-present love, and a knowing that everything will be okay. I awoke to it all, opened my once clouded eyes, and hooked into this inside story, love. And this next one is Remember Your True Story. Divinity is written on my bones as scripture, woven into my muscles, incandescent in my nervous system. All I have to do is open my inner eyes to read the lines of love and light and remember. I get distracted with what the outer eyes see, with what the trickster in my mind reads to me. But when I move my body with nature, with dance, with divine breath, when I sweep away the cluttered thoughts, I remember. Light and love flow through every cell of my body and gift me with another moment of beautiful life. Troubled life. Complex life. Sad life. Wonderful, happy, amazing life. When I feel and see and remember, I smile like the sun on the clearest spring day. You can remember too. Read your divine chapters and feel them in your bones. Open your truest eyes and see.
All right, next up is Christine. Where are you at, Christine?
Over there. All right.
This is when my mom got older and I started doing a little bit of writing. She gave me a lot of material, needless to say. So I can just be sitting there looking at her, talking to her, and just looking into her eyes, and this just hit me. Mary's eyes. Her eyes are clear as they age. Their clearness invited me. I wanted to see what they have seen in 94 years. Her mother, father, siblings in the tar paper shack they called home. Her father's desk in the attic, where she watched him pen the paperwork. My father's handsome face, full of surprise in front of the tire store as he is set up by her boss to take her to dinner, then home. Her firstborn, trying to understand why he would not utter his first words. The war, the depression, the rations of food and gas, young men leaving home and some blessed to return. Days that we would never understand now. Her eyes are so clear, even as age has started to cloud her mind. A long sentence will get lost in those eyes. Keep them short, I remind myself. And this one here, I ride horses, and that was just always my place to go away. So I would just escape my horse. It just always made me feel so good. So that's what brought this one around. Grounded. If I was asked what it is about your horse that keeps you riding, he grounds me. That is my answer. I thought of this as we went exploring new territory. It's all new, barn, other horses, trails. So many news for me this year. Now it was his turn. Yes, 1,200 pounds of muscle with a mind that says I'm not afraid of that this time, but next time I will be. Yet in the saddle grounds me. So this ride near the lake, as I breathe in the fresh air and turn him around, I softly say thank you with a pat on his neck, for I am now grounded. We can head back.
Next up, we have Margaret Casper Reed.
Okay, driving to work. For 34 years, middle school, high school, for another 10 years, college. I always went down College Avenue. And on College Avenue, there's a sign that says the Emptied Redemption Center. And, you know, we take in all of these words. So this is the Empty Redemption Center. Okay. At the Empty Redemption Center on College Avenue, Elmira places a plaque for all the bums, victims of bum raps, bum rushes, bum steers, failed design parlances, for everyone who's burnt out, worn out, run out of steam. All the recyclables they've pulled from trash bins melt together, become translucent pods, prime real estate. Scarecrows get their straw back. Mail sorters find hundreds of thank you letters with their names on them. Taxicab drivers get to sit in the back seat of Happy's blue taxi, while the meter zips along and Happy puffs on his cigar. On their break, the nurses in 4D get tucked in beds with hand-embroidered pillows, while candy stripers read them Charlotte's Web. All the canaries come back to life, zigzag through railroad bridge trellises. Everyone who's worked a third shift gets to sleep in. And when they wake up, breakfast is delivered by children in footed pajamas, known in the family lore as huggy buggies. Everybody who's burned a bridge gets to swing across the Chemung River on a rope, yodeling, sit in the downtown park, build a bonfire, toast marshmallows, golden giveaways. All the noses that have been set to grind stones pull away, smell. What is that? Mint, of course, mint. All those rusty hatchets that have been buried stay there. Slates wipe cream, clean, glistening like sleds skidding down Reformatory Hill. Never ever coming close to the disaster of the cyclone fence. All part-time employees get full-time benefits and corner offices straight away. Time no longer has to be worked against, measured in light years and test scores, epochs and eras collapse. Everything becomes circa. Everything is coeval, all the same age, just the right age, at just the right time. It all works out at the Empty Redemption Center on College Avenue.
All right. Probably going to get Paul. Is it Zarl? Zadrail. Paul Zadrail. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to participate at Hemingway's open mic. I have 10 lines for you, two poems. First one, walk around oxygen. A feng shui joystick, GameStop curio, toadstool Muppet in Dag Byrne effigy. How I shrivel the eternal costume. Comparable pretext, lake farm eggplant. Ingraham fodder, and yes, that Ingraham. Wonton organelle with Blood Magazine, the pointless debate and Rorschach flowchart, a unicorn cripple, short stack helix, derelict lard purview, cancel culture. Arguably devoid, what not is hype. Lawn art sycophant, John Deere native dirt.
All right, we're going to finish things off with Mr. Joe Calden.
Gone too soon. I never really knew you. My friend Dan, gone before our 30th reunion. My first friend with a car, a 1982 Pontiac Grand Prix, midnight blue exterior, matching velour interior. The county was our oyster. His life, my life, moody, like that Better Than Ezra song. I remember running through the wet grass, falling a step behind. Our lives later, our separate lives. We were going to meet up for drinks, for conversation someday. Always someday. His life, my life, typical Generation X, never made it to the shining city on the hill. Thank you.
All right. Another round of applause for the open mic participants. Thank you all for coming. Tip your bartenders well. There's still some books on the counter. We'll be back in 2 weeks. What's the date? June 11th. So we'll see you then. Thanks a lot for coming out. We appreciate it. Thank you.